question?
Yes. I guess, are you done with the basic?
Yes.
Well, I was trying to figure out is the there's a nearshore juvenile Atlantic cod, HAPC, that would be from mean low water out to 20 meters. And
yes.
Has that been lumped in with another one? I didn't really see it as a separate alternative. We're just very interested because that's where all the non-fishing impacts happen. And
right.
from our perspective as friends of Penobscot Bay, we want to make sure that's
yeah.
dealt with.
So it's definitely an alternative that's part of this amendment. The EFH and HAPC updates, the council actually identified their preferences there a number of years ago. And so that's, right now, the same as all that I was talking about, this mm-hmm. is preferred, that is preferred, with these the things I was talking about today, that inshore to 20 meters HAPC is also preferred by the council at this point.
But just to follow up, I wondered, because I'd noted everything else, you said, here's a donut hole because here's state
right.
waters. And are you managing to coordinate with DMR and the other state agencies? This sounds like a
yeah.
hugely complicated thing, this nearshore one.
Yes, and I mean, that's sort of one of the tricky things. When we first started talking about looking at, you know, fishing impacts, which, you know, the council, you know, is managing fishing activity, not, you know, non-fishing things, we actually focused, you know, outside of, beyond state waters, because there's pretty limited federally permitted fishing activity there. So in terms of actions going into this amendment, we didn't really focus on it. But obviously there's a lot going on in the near shore coastal zone, and a really big way in which the EFH designations and especially the HAPC designations are used is in what's called the EFH consultation process. The council's largely hand that over to NOAA Fisheries, but basically anyone, you know, federal folks who are trying to do projects in those areas, they have to consult and say, well, what would be the habitat impacts of this? And so NOAA Fisheries gets an opportunity to comment and say, well, there's, you know, these species there, and also this is an HAPC and we think it's particularly important. So, and then there's, you know, sort of a back and forth about potential mitigation measures and such.
You mean like if there's a dredging project, something like that?
Yeah, exactly. So once this HAPC is formally designated, it'll have a lot of, you know, I don't know, maybe a lot is maybe a strong word, but it'll have a role in the consultation process in terms of highlighting that that habitat is important.
Great, thanks.
Yeah.
I really, really look forward to that.
It's not something the council really has a lot, you know, ability to...
Going back to the beginning here, I'm a little, still a little confused with when I hear the word habitat in this day and age, you think of a broader spectrum of the ecosystem and all that would entail. Now this whole thing, I realize, as you just said, you're the Fisheries Management Council and you're dealing with fishing activities. But how do we use this information if it's just dealing with, it's almost like all you've described is a throwback to single species management or groups of species. We have what's the cod doing, what are juvenile cod doing here, but there's no description of the habitat itself or what kelp is there, or what deep water coral is there, or any other aspects of that ecosystem. So do you bring that together ever, and does this become useful information to everybody else?
Right. So I think to the extent that we can, I'm not sure how well the document does this right now. The idea is to try and be pretty comprehensive in terms of describing what's going on in a place. So is there kelp, are there deep water corals? What's the overlying oceanography? Definitely, you know, fish live on the bottom and in the water column, and the temperature and salinity and current regime and food in the water column is affecting their distribution. We really focused on the benthos here because that's where we think the fishing impacts are accumulating, you know, and that generally fishing isn't affecting the properties of the water column. That's sort of independent of fishing for the most part. But I think some of these, and we took an individual species perspective because, you know, working from the ground up, and then tried to aggregate it in some ways, you know, by like a group of brownfish species or something like that. But I think some of what you're talking about is going to be the next phase for the council. The council's already committed, you know, a number of times to looking at ecosystem, more holistic ecosystem-based management. So, you know, thinking about how prey resources really fit into all this. And so this amendment is a bit narrower than that. And I think, you know, down the road, once this is completed, then it can be a jumping off point for sort of a more holistic approach. But I'm not sure we're fully there yet. And it's one thing to describe those ecosystems. I think actually managing to keep them in mind is probably going to be a little trickier. So this is definitely a first step and not the end of that kind of process. Do you have another question?
Yeah, I just wanted you to talk about, when you were talking about the North South Bay and the eastern part of the coast, and I heard you say data poor, that means you don't have a lot of data for that, and scientific uncertainty. I just want you to make decisions where you have scientific certainty and good data. So I think everyone should know that when you say those words, that means you really don't have a good handle on what you're making your decisions.
Yeah.
I just want everyone to know that those two things mean you're really not sure.
Yeah, the council talks about amount, you know, presence and absence of data all the time. And we had this discussion, especially this week, in the context of what we know and don't know about fish distributions offshore of Cape Cod. I guess the final action will be sort of a balance of taking some action in the face of uncertainty and holding off where the council really doesn't feel like it has enough information to know it's, you know, because there are unintended consequences of these areas if they're not cited well, for sure. And that's definitely, you know, a concern the council's well aware of, I would say. Yeah.
My comment is kind of related to that, or my question. You said one option that the council is considering is in the Eastern Gulf of Maine to also regulate gear types such as gillnets and longlines. And because we don't know a lot about what's going on there, and my understanding of those gear types in that area is that the impacts are already really minimal. I'm wondering if you can explain more of the reasoning behind also regulating those gear types, and then another question is, you said that the habitat research areas are potentially going to have a sunset provision, and I don't know if you said about the closures or not, but is there going to be a sunset provision for the closures as well if it's decided that they're not really having an impact?
Great, thanks. So her questions were, I guess to take the second one first, about sunset provisions and when closures would be revisited. Part of that goes into if we make changes to sort of the way we think about frameworks and monitoring and updating the system of area management. So we talked about somewhere anywhere up to 10 years interval, and sort of at whatever interval the council decides is appropriate, sort of take a comprehensive look at all the areas and decide if they're still making sense. Then I'm not sure I'm going to have a great answer for you in terms of the first question, which was, what's the rationale behind restricting gill nets or long lines in the eastern Maine area? That's something that we really just discussed for the first time 3 days ago. The idea is that, you know, not just affecting the seabed, but removing the groundfish is affecting the ecosystem. But, you know, certainly the data I've looked at and the data we already have in the EIS is that those kinds of removals and use of those gears is pretty limited in these areas already. So, you know, hopefully part of what we can provide with the analyses in this document is a sense of what's the magnitude of different types of fishing. And so by restricting them, how much benefit would you be getting? I think the idea with that area is that because there's so many changes happening, the hope is that there would be, you know, a change in brownfish populations that an increase in them that you wouldn't want to see lost as soon as it's happening. So restrict all gears that can catch groundfish. but we haven't in detail really thought about, you know, what the impacts would be or how much those types of gears are used to catch ratfish in those areas, because it's something the council sort of just raised recently. Other questions? Yeah.
Back on the different alternatives, you had alternative three, I think it was. Can you go back to that slide?
Yeah, in Eastern Maine, Central Maine.
Western Maine.
Eastern Maine.
Now, along the coast of Maine, in that area, is where 50% of the shrimp landings during our shrimp season comes from that area that you're planning on closing, but not necessarily alternative. Are you aware of that?
I guess it was like 45%, but yeah.
Well.
Right, yeah. Yes, definitely. So that's part of what we're looking at in terms of in the economic impacts analysis discusses, you know, in the short term, you know, without a shrimp fishery happening next year, there's sort of no effect. But in the longer term, this is an area that's very important. Something that the council actually talked about on Tuesday was, so this area, this Jeffrey's Ledge area, sort of west of that boundary, historically there was quite a bit of shrimp activity when the season went a bit longer and the animals were a little further offshore. And so the council would like to see, you know, shrimping as an exempted gear in that area if the Western Gulf of Maine closure remains. You know, right now the council's leaning towards no action here, so, and definitely fishery impacts in the Bigelow Bight are a big concern. And one of the things, because that's a pretty near shore area, you know, something we try and disentangle the analysis is the ability of those vessels to go somewhere else. And I think for a lot of those smaller vessels that the shrimp are inshore and they're sort of limited in their range, then there probably is a very limited ability to go anywhere else. So
that also affects the small boats having to go further off.
Yeah, for sure. The New Hampshire smaller boats, yeah.
Just to follow up to that, the shrimp gear should be under gear designation exempted gear. Those type of areas, maybe not the habitat because of the
right.
designation of bottom tending gear.
Right.
But we would like to see in the shrimp fishery an exemption for shrimp gear in any of those areas, because we really don't affect habitat with the type of gear and the amount of effort we put into some of those areas.
Yeah.
So I think a gear designation attached to that would help a lot as a fisherman concerned.
Yeah, and definitely there's a difference in terms of, you know, ground fish catch between a shrimp trawl and, you know, trawls that are designed to take ground fish.
Yeah. We have
and the width of the gear. And
we have a fish excluder that's required, so we let go over 90% of juvenile fish.
Yeah, and it's currently an exempted gear from the ground fish closure. Recognizing that. I think the other thing is also sort of shrimp gear, or even to a greater extent a gear like a hydraulic clam dredge. There's, you know, based on the distribution of the animals those gears are targeting, they're, you know, shrimp gear isn't really fishing on top of some of the hardest bottom. I think the animals are really more of a mud. So that's something we sort of talk about in terms of the necessity for restricting those gears.
Mud in between the actual habitat bottom up on the ground.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, one of the great things and also the challenges is that a lot of these, you know, it's not like these areas are uniformly vulnerable hard bottom, especially in the inshore Gulf of Maine. There's muddy patches with interspersed with rock in and around the Great South Channel. There's a lot of, you know, and out on Georges Bank, there's a lot of patchiness to the habitat. And so how do you protect what you think is important to protect while allowing access in between is, you know, hopefully we get some reasonable answers there.
Yeah, hopefully you get it right. There's lots of fish, and we make God one makes a good living, and all that big smile that can never find.
Yeah. Sorry.
One more question on the roll enclosures.
Yeah.
The area that encompasses the Still Wagon Bank, that is closed presently for 1 month at a time, for 1 month in the spring for the
right.
enclosures.
In April, I believe.
And
Yeah.
Why is it only closed for 1 month and every other block's closed for 2 months.
I don't know. I never...
Never noticed that?
We asked that question. Yeah, I noticed it, but it's,
It used to be closed almost 7 months of the year.
Right.
Now it's only closed for 1 month. All the other blocks are closed for 2 months.
Yeah.
But I see that as a fairness of access issue for Maine fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
We're closed out of blocks for 2 months.
More time.
And Massachusetts fishermen are closed out for 1 month.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it's an artifact, obviously, of how they were originally developed, and I don't know what the rationale was for their design. But it's not something I thought about when I heard. It's a good question. Yes, sir.
If I may, the original rolling closures were developed from UNH research with tagging and recapture studies in the Gulf of Maine. And because I believe that that is only a 1 month closure because it is very temperature dependent for spawning access. And so they saw that the cod were only resident during that 1 month and they could roll up the coast to protect the closures. So to answer his question, I believe it is an artifact of the mark recapture study and when there were cod actively spawning in that area and when they were fully dispersed.
Huh, good to know. Yeah, I'll look into that more then. I think that's interesting. Yes, sir.
I have a few for 10 minutes here, so this may be missed already, but a couple of process questions. First of all, Gary, earlier you talked about the boundaries and I think the Eastern Gulf of Maine proposed closure. Am I correct in assuming that the public comment stage would be too late to modify those boundaries? You've got this wrong, this is what the boundaries should be, it would be too late at that point.
The council modifies stuff all the way until like the very 11th hour, so no.
So you can actually see public comment influence the boundary of something's proposed area?
I think it could, and it very well should. And this, up till now, I mean, every time we bring these options to the council, things are massaged a bit. So really, this stage is kind of where we say, all right, here's what we've got. Let's analyze it as completely as we can, send it out to the public, and comment on this set of alternatives that will at least remain static for the next 6 or 7 months.
So relative minor change of boundaries wouldn't result in the need for another whole analysis of the delays for another 10 years?
Well, I'm not a NOAA lawyer, but I think, if there's major adjustments that weren't contemplated at all within the range of what we've got here, then we probably need to do some more analysis and maybe release some supplemental information. But generally speaking, if it's an adjustment that's pretty minor and it's basically covered by the analysis, then we just adjust the document and before it's finalized. And so definitely we want to hear about suggestions like that during yes, sure.
Mm-hmm. And my other question is, just in the context of the existing habitat closures that have been in place for very long time, and you may not be the right person to ask this, but I bet you were anyway. Are there studies available to the public that show the effects of these habitat closures? Cash flow closures, the close for a five or anything, whatever it is.
Yeah, I'm not sure how well we've captured that research in the discussion, but it should be in there by the time we publish the draft. Definitely, some of these areas more than others, Western Gulf of Maine more than Caches, but there have been people looking and monitoring these areas since they closed and before then, and trying to evaluate recovery and that kind of thing. So, to the extent that those studies exist, I'll try and make sure they're clearly identified. Because, one question here that's kind of hard to answer, but that type of research goes into is, two areas that otherwise seem pretty similar in terms of their bottom type and the fish that are there and the fisheries that might occur there, and one's been closed and one's been open, is it more beneficial to keep an area closed or more beneficial to switch it up if the economic effects seem better of doing that? And how you assign a benefit to an existing closure is a little bit tricky. Great. Thanks for listening to me. I appreciate it.